I'm very pleased to introduce Stephen Rose, welcoming back to Marxism. Stephen is a professor at the Open University and the author, as I'm sure people will be familiar, of a number of books, including Not in Our Genes and recently The Making of Memory. Stephen's going to speak tonight on Is Our Behaviour in Our Genes? He'll be speaking for about 35 to 40 minutes, after which there'll be plenty of time for discussion. That's going to take place through speaker slips. There'll be stewards wandering up and down with pieces of paper. If you want to speak, fill one in and hand it back. And we'll try and ensure there's as broad a discussion as possible. I would just encourage people, if you want to ask simple questions even, do come down and use the mics. It'll make the discussion much more enjoyable. Now I'll hand over to Stephen.
Thanks very much, but Megan didn't do quite what I asked her. She sent out and she introduced me, and I said it was quite clear, because I'm introduced very well in last week's spoken feedback on the screen.
Why's the screen coming down?
I was introduced very well in last week's British National Party spearhead document, which I'll quote it. And it relates to the libel suit now going on by which they're trying to screw Housemans and Bookmarks. A number of bookshops have settled out of court and are now refusing to stop the rag, that's spearhead. That's Searchlight. Housemans and Bookmarks, which will go run by the lunatic Trotskyist SWP, the official bookseller to the TUC, have decided to fight the case, however. They're receiving backing from the usual ragbag of Trot, Zionists, and Cranks. These include MPs Jeremy Corbyn, Tony Benn, Peter Hay, Professor Stephen Rose, etc. Well, as I explained to you, Megan, I'm certainly not a Zionist, I'm not sure about a Trot, so that's certainly meant to be a crank, so you're in about a crankly, and that's why we've got the screen there. Well, they gave us, discussing this with John Rees, he suggested the title Is Our Behaviour in Our Genes, and you probably know the answer that I'm going to give to this. Can we do something about that feedback? Partly because, is it still okay without that? Yeah, okay. Partly because I've spoken here in Logan Halls on a number of occasions on topics similar to this. I want to try to do something slightly different today. I want to firstly, as it were, introduce the issue about why we're in this current wave of genetic determinism and what it implies, both for our politics and our understanding of science. But I want to try to use the second half of what I have to say to try to do something a bit more positive. It's quite easy to do the knocking copy turn. But what we've got to do, it seems to me, is to be able to say, well, if these claims of genetic determinism are there and we're knocking them down, what sort of vision do we have of what we are as humans living in society, but as biological living organisms in society, which is different from the determinist view which is given by biological determinism, and which I'll spend the first part talking about. So that's essentially the agenda that I'd like to set out in the 30, 35 minutes that I should be talking. And let's see if we can actually do it in that time. But let me begin then, just as it were, revising, if you like, what I think are the issues. I don't know if you're going to be able to see the transparencies. And can you see them more or less at the back? Great, okay. What? I missed that, Greg. Anyhow, they're reasonably visible. They ask some pretty straightforward questions. Where should we look to explain and change our personal condition and the society around us? And then I have a set of violence, criminality, poverty, sexuality, favourite life ambition, etc., etc., etc. And basically, we're given three sorts of answers to those questions. And you know essentially what those answers are. One answer says the fault lies in society. And in which case we understand it by the tools of social science and we try to change it by the tools of politics and political struggle. Or does a fault lie in how we and our children grow up? If that's the case, then we're into personal lifestyle change and into psychotherapy and we take family life histories and we blame our parents and all the other things that we can do. Or does it lie in our biology? If it lies in our biology, what we need is the brain sciences, neuroscience, that's my science, and genetics, the science of heredity, to explain it, pharmacology, drugs, to change it. And this is what I'm calling neurogenetic determinism. Now, what sort of determinism is involved in this, and why is it important? If we say that something inside us is causing us to behave in particular sorts of ways, whether it's to be disaffected from society or to be have a sexual orientation which is different from that of the majority or whatever, then some people say, well, the cause can still be environmental. Eating junk food makes us violent or poor learners. And you can go into any health food store in, certainly in London, I suspect right away over Britain, and you'll find vitamin supplements labelled high IQ, and you take them, and you're instantly supposed to do better at A-levels or even get first at university. But more often, the claim is the causes are genetic. And the sorts of arguments that we've seen over the last years is that a man is homosexual because he has a gay brain, and that's the result of having gay genes. And I've asked why are there no lesbian genes, but somehow lesbianism doesn't seem to be an interesting topic for biological determinists to study. And then there's violence on the streets because people have violent or criminal genes. People get drunk because they have genes for alcoholism. Women are depressed because they have genes for depression. And sometimes, as we know very well, the genetic story is applied to brutes. Whites have genes for higher IQ than blacks. Men have genes for patriarchal domination over women. Of course, those two can come together, as they did in the recent case of the lecturer Chris Brand, which is now trash book in Edinburgh. Brand, of course, published a book claiming both that blacks were genetically inferior to whites and also that the cause of a lot of social deprivation in Britain was low IQ, stupid women, having single mothers, having children, and what they really ought to do is to mate with high IQ males and raise the general intelligence of the population. It's not surprising under those circumstances that many students found Mr. Brand's lectures unacceptable and boycotted. What we're dealing with in the arguments about this sort of determinism, biological determinism, are very serious. Because what they're doing is they're taking essentially issues which belong in the social domain, whether it's criminality or violence or anything else, and they're essentially arguing that the explanation for these has to be found in the biological domain. And biological determinism is important as well, partly because it has a feeling of inevitability about it. It's not something that we can change society about. It's almost not something we can change ourselves about. And the determinists don't argue quite in those blunt terms, but that's actually what they mean. Just to give you some examples of the way that these arguments have been running recently, some of you may have noticed last year the medical foundation, the SIBA Foundation, held a closed meeting in London in February of last year with the title The Genetics of Criminal and Antisocial Behaviour. Now this was a meeting to which they had imported a significant number of American speakers, partly because attempts to hold a similar meeting twice in the States were blocked, particularly by black groups who claimed, I think with some justice, that the arguments were being advanced were purely racist. That is, the attempt to find a genetic explanation for the criminality and violence in American society was aimed specifically at inner city youth, and particularly the black and ethnic minority youths in the inner cities. And you can see that very clearly in the way the arguments ran. But what I'm interested in here is the things that are taken for granted, even in the very introduction to this book, by a man who is a distinguished, not American, but British social psychologist, Michael Rutter, from the Institute of Psychiatry in Denmark Hill, here in London. Firstly, he takes for granted that there is a condition which might be called the antisocial personality disorder. That is, if you're hostile to the forms of society, this is a disorder. It's become medicalized. Furthermore, there's a conduct disorder. Conduct disorder starts in something called an oppositional stroke defiant disorder. Now, I suspect that's a medical condition. At least I hope that's a medical condition which affects a very large number of people in this room. Now, where does this disorder come from? Well, it actually comes from problems that you have in childhood called pervasive early onset hyperactivity or inattention. That means you're a poor learner in school, and it carries an increased risk of later antisocial behaviour. And it's predictive of antisocial behaviour that persists into adult life. Now, the point about these definitions of antisocial behaviour, the point about this entire book about genetics of criminal and antisocial behaviour, is to think about what they're talking about. What they're talking about is crimes against property. What they're talking about is the crimes of violence. What they're talking about is essentially, therefore, working class crime. No one in this book has, so far as I can see, ever thought about pursuing the question of the genetics of bank fraud. And yet, it would seem to me that this was an equally legitimate argument to actually employ, if you're interested in the genetics of these things. So, genetics becomes... these claims of biological determinism become in this way not merely an application of biology, but an application of biology as a social weapon. And if we don't understand the mix of science, ideology, and technology that comes together in these sorts of claims, then I think that one is missing, I think, the point and the seriousness of what's happening at the moment. Just to give you a feeling for the way the arguments go again, I've taken two or three quotations here from distinguished behaviour geneticists and sociobiologists. In a sense, they say, all behaviour must be coded for by genes. Reduced to its simplest form, behaviour is nothing more than a series of nerve impulses and muscle contractions, and the protein structure of nerve and muscle is coded for by genetic instructions. What are the implications of this? Well, they are implications of inevitability. How do we explain, for example, differences between school performance in mathematics by boys and girls? This comes from the States. The overabundance of mathematically talented males is, says Sandra Starr, who is, or when she wrote this, was president of the American Psychological Association, is, I believe, due to prenatal exposure to testosterone. The reason for the difference is that there's an excess of males exposed prenatally to testosterone, and they're basically processing information in a different way from individuals not exposed to high concentrations of testosterone. Now, I don't know how we then explain the fact that, on the whole, these days, girls are doing rather better than boys at school in most of these conditions. I suppose, in fact, there's a high proportion of testosterone in the diet which has to account for it. Is this inevitable? Well, feeding a well-nourished but short child more and more will not give him the stature of a basketball player. Feeding a below-average intellect more and more information will not make her brilliant. Now, this is essentially, therefore, the argument that I want to look at, the argument of inevitability. And just again, before we actually get into the details of how these claims are made, let me give you again the full range of the claims. And the archetypal exponent of biological determinism these days is a man called J. Philippe Rushton. J. Philippe Rushton was a pupil of Hans Eysenck here in England before going to work in Canada. And he's made himself slightly notorious in the States and Canada by publishing books claiming, for example, that blacks are less intelligent on average than whites, girls are less intelligent on average than boys. On the other hand, blacks have larger cock sizes than whites, and this makes them more fecund, they have more children. And therefore, inevitably, the intelligence of the American community is declining. On the other hand, there's some hope for it, because in Rushton's view, Asians have smaller cocks but bigger brains than do the white Caucasians in the States. Rushton is now going around the shopping malls of the United States asking men, firstly, how long their cocks are. And secondly, I wish I was joking, and secondly, how far they can ejaculate. Rushton's recent book, and you won't be able to read this, I'm putting it up here simply for fun, lists a whole series of what they call heritability estimates. That is how far certain things are in our genes. And these are beliefs. You have a 51% likelihood of heritability of believing in the death penalty, for example. 35% of Sabbath observance, 27% of hippies, and so on. On the other hand, Fortunately, pyjama parties are relatively common. Socialism, I see, rose at 26%. Okay, now, what's... I mean, it's funny, yes, of course it's funny, but it's also dead serious. It's dead serious for a whole lot of reasons. And the reasons are, I think, listed like this. What are the consequences of this sort of belief in biological determinism? Firstly, it's blaming the victim. It's not the fault of society, it's the fault somehow of you. You've got the wrong genes, your parents threw you up wrongly, or you've somehow sort of been eating the wrong sort of food. And therefore, it's your problem. That sometimes gets switched round, and it gets switched round in the context of fatalism. And one of the interesting ways is the way the whole gay gene argument has been taken up in the United States, in which quite a number of gay and lesbian groups have been arguing that, in fact, it's a good thing that genes have ostensibly been discovered for homosexuality, although not for homophobia, as I said, because somehow this means you can't blame us because it's in our genes, it's a medical problem, therefore. Your children can't catch it from us, so it's okay for us to teach school. Very recently, a man called Chandler Burr was being written and proselytizing a book. This was last week. I heard him on the Today program proselytizing a book which makes this claim very clearly, that there are gay brains, there are specific sites in the brain which are different in gay men from straight men. Again, this is all about males and not about lesbians. And secondly, that this is a result of the genes. And thirdly, it's a good thing that this is the case. Now, I don't know what the view of gays and lesbians in this audience is. Maybe that's something we want to discuss afterwards. I would, however, say that those who think that a biological difference can absolve you from stigma in society, or even a social difference can absolve you from stigma in society, need to think very carefully about the fate of the mentally defective, the homosexuals, as well as the Jews and the Gypsies in Nazi Germany. Biology does not save them from the racism or the homophobia of society. The third point is a point that I call syndromitis, that is this medicalization of social problems. And there's a whole list that I've actually sort of put up there. And I've added to those, of course, this antisocial personality disorder and many of the others that we're thinking of here. Once you can call something a disorder, then the answer is that you can find drugs for it. You locate it not in the society, but in the individual. One of the disturbing things that's happened over the course of the last couple of years in Britain, for example, has been the introduction into this country of a drug, a diagnosis called attention deficit disorder for children, and a drug which is intended to treat it. Something like 10% of all American young boys aged between 8 and 13 are now receiving daily doses of a drug manufactured by Cedar Guiley called Ritalin. This is on the basis of diagnosis on school report. That is, they are being diagnosed on the basis of school report of being poor learners, being disruptive in class, inattentive to their teachers, and so on. Now, attention deficit disorder is a very strange disorder. It tends to remit at the weekends and the school holidays. This ought to begin with to tell you something about it. But nonetheless, all other explanations that the teacher's a lousy teacher, which I know there are teachers in this room, does happen to some of us and all of us. The teacher doesn't get on with the kid. The kid doesn't get on with the school in a whole variety of ways. All these potential explanations are stripped to one side, and instead we have a biological explanation. There must be something wrong with your brain. If there's something wrong with your brain, we can drug it. And that's essentially the argument which has been won the day for very many parents in the United States. I'm particularly disturbed because I see it now coming to Britain over the course of the last year or so. There have been a number of parents groups, and a number of psychiatrists have started the parents groups pressing for the psychiatrists prescribing Ritalin in this particular sort of way. If you want to see the nexus that's involved in this, you can also remember that in the States, the Cedar Guiley Corporation pays the parents groups which press for the use of Ritalin in this way something like $750,000 a year on official US government figures in order to keep the parents' groups and the pressure for the drug going. And that seems to me to be something which we're in grave danger of moving in that direction here. Okay, so that's what happens when you medicalize a social problem. And you take the problem out of the domain of the interaction between individuals, and you put it sort of back in the domain of the child. Okay. Subversion of scarce resources. Well, there's a great deal of concern, for example, in the United States at the moment about violence in American society, as well there might be. It's a society with one of the highest murder rates ever recorded in the world. Homicide is a major cause of death amongst young American males, particularly young black American males. So what do we have? We have something called the Violence Initiative in the United States, which you might think had something to do with alleviating the discrepancy between rich and poor, doing something about drugs in society, doing something about 280 million handguns in society. Not doing any of those things. That $50 million is going to begin to look at the genetic roots of aggression and violence in young inner city kids, mainly in the Chicago area. And if it's not the genetic roots, it's in the first few months of their lives when the argument is that the way that their parents are treating them, or the way that food that they're eating, or the way that their brain is developing, is going to turn them inevitably into violent homicidal criminals as they grow older. That's one of the features of subversion of scarce resources. And the final point I've listed here is the creation of dangerous myths and fantasies. And that's the argument that there are genes for behavior. The argument that one can go directly between the genotype and the way in which we behave in complex societies is precisely that sort of myth. You can scarcely open the pages of newspapers today without finding, as I've said, genes for everything from homelessness to compulsive shopping. Both of those are real examples, by the way. Nor these famous metaphors about the genome as a code or a map or a telephone directory of life, in which people's life history lies, as in that quotation that I gave you, entirely in their genes. And this is the ultimate scientific claim of genetic determinism, and it's that claim that I want to turn to now. And in the next 15 or so minutes, I want to try to ask, why is that claim so prevalent? Where does it come from? And what's the alternative vision of the way in which we live as biological organisms in the world that we can offer? Let me tell you a fable, okay? It's nothing to do with biological determinism or anything else. There's a pond and a frog sitting by it. Five biologists are watching the frog by the pond. And suddenly, the frog jumps into the pond. And each biologist asks, as biologists will do, well, why is the frog jumping into the pond? And one biologist, physiologist, says, well, the frog's muscles are contracting, and the frog's muscles are contracting because before then there's a message down the nerve fiber from the frog's brain to the muscles, and that's why they're contracting. So something's going on in the brain, then something's going on in the nerves, then something's going on in the muscles, and that's why the frog is jumping. Now that, if you like, is a causal sequence. First one thing happens, and then another thing happens. And that's the way physiologists tend to try to understand it. Second biologist says, yeah, but did you see that snake over there? The frog is jumping into the pond because it knows the snake's going to eat, and it's jumping to escape the pond, the snake. That's the sort of explanation that a behavioral ecologist would give. They look at the frog in its environment, they see the various things which are demanding that the frog jumps under a particular circumstance, and the frog jumps, and they explain that way. The third biologist says, well, none of this would have happened if it hadn't happened that when the frog was moving from a frog's egg to a tadpole to a frog, the wiring, the nerves didn't wire up to the brain in that particular sort of way. So we have to look at the development of the way these things wire up. That's what a developmental biologist says. Fourth biologist says, yeah, but look, we've got to look not just at the development of the frog, but we've got to look at the entire history of other frogs. This frog jumped in order to escape the snake because earlier ancestors also jumped to escape the snake, and those ancestors which didn't jump fast enough got eaten up by the snake at those times. And so evolutionary history pressured frogs to jump very fast when they saw snakes, and that's why this frog jumps this way. That's an evolutionary explanation. Fifth biologist says, come on, let's really get down to basics. Why is the frog jumping? Yes, I agree with the physiologist, because its muscles are contracting. Why are its muscles contracting? Well, its muscles are contracting because muscles are made of two proteins, one called actin, one called myosin, and they're sort of like thin filaments, and they slide across one another in this sort of way, like a sort of ratchet system. So the muscle contracts. Why does the actin and myosin do this? Because they're made of amino acids. Why amino acids do this? Because they're made of molecules of particular sorts of structure. And in the last analysis, we get down to the atoms. And there's nothing left in the world except atoms and molecules which we can study in this way. That's what biochemists say, and that's what chemists say, and molecular biologists say, and I'm a biochemist by training. So biochemists want to imperialize all the other explanations that exist in biology, and they in turn are imperialized by molecular biologists, by chemists, and by physicists, and so on. So indeed, in the last analysis, to understand the world, we have to take it to pieces and manipulate all its components. And when you do that, you get this classical hierarchy, which some of you will be able to see, of the way in which different sciences are organized. Up at the top here, you've got sociology. Down at the bottom here, you've got physical sciences. And in between, you've got chemistry, biochemistry, physiology, psychology, and so on. And the task of science is to collapse all these explanations down, ultimately, to the one grand unifying explanation we can make in physics. And so we collapse behavior into DNA, and DNA into the sequence of structures that there are there. That is the crucial claim of reductionism. And that is the claim which underlies biologically determinist thinking. It's important because the politics have come out of it. It's important because it represents a mainstream way of the way that science has been done in the Western world over the course of the last 200-300 years. And there's a long argument in a book I wrote a few years ago called Not in Our Genes, trying to explain why this way of thinking was precisely compatible with the growth and development of early capitalism through from the birth of science in the 17th century, through the 19th century, and indeed into the present century as well. But it is a very poor way of understanding science. It's a very poor way of understanding living systems. It's a way which gives you those crude and simple explanations. And it's a way which gives you, therefore, explanations which are very satisfying to those people who don't want to consider the sociology, the politics, and so on, but do want to try to reduce everything to very simple arguments about biochemistry or about chemistry. And you will pick up again and again popular books written by Richard Dawkins, books written by E.O. Wilson, books written by John Maynard Smith, which will make these sorts of claims. If you go down the road from here to the Darwin seminars, which are run week on week at LSE, and very popular they are too, they are an unashamed claim for this sort of reductionist explanation. A reductionist explanation which insists on reducing everything about living systems from the social, from the complexity of living organisms, down to the level of the molecules and down to the level of the DNA. That's essentially the science which lies behind the genes for behavior, the sorts of biological determinants, and the sort of political arguments that we were discussing. So, how do we answer those claims? How do we answer what seems to be the seductive claim that, yes, of course, you can use all these higher order explanations, but in the last analysis, there are only atoms. That's what we've got to explain. Well, it's here that I want to turn to look, I think, at what are the alternatives. As a biologist, and as someone who's very concerned with the way biological explanations are used in society as a whole, the first thing that we have to say is that we cannot read off from genes, life histories. Humans, all living organisms, live not in the one dimension of a sequence of letters, of the A's and the T's and the C's and the G's that give them the DNA. We live in four dimensions. We live in three dimensions of space and one dimension of time. What do I mean by time? Well, I mean, firstly, the evolutionary history, which has created us as living organisms, as members of the human species. Secondly, the social history, which has created all of us as members of the society living at this particular moment, in a peculiar history of the way that Western capitalism and Western industrial society have developed. And thirdly, I mean the time which is our own individual life space, our own trajectories, our own unique trajectories through life. If I could take a cerebroscope, a special machine, and look at the motion of every molecule in your brain or my brain at this given moment, I would not be able to predict what it is you are thinking and where you're going to go in the future. And I would not be able to predict it because the present state of any one of those molecules makes sense only in the context of its past history. Marx understood this very well, and Engels understood this very well so far as human history is concerned. I would argue that this principle applies to the history of all living organisms. No living organism is understandable except in the context of its own history. We make our own history. The second crucial point, which goes into this alternative analysis, let me put it up, in fact, in a rather pompous sort of way, because there are 10 points there, and I'm not actually going to be able to discuss more than a very small number of those particular points. And I put them up in more or less formal philosophical language. I know that audiences at Marxism schools are very well able to deal with very complex concepts, and you won't mind me doing that. But let me actually say what I mean by some of them, and let me reinterpret them. Okay, what I mean by the first, ontological unity, epistemological diversity. It's very simple, although despite the complex language. Firstly, we live in one material world. We're all materialists. Anyone who's come through any sort of Marxist background has to be, because that's a fundamental premise with which Marxism operates. The fact that we live in one material world doesn't mean there's only one way of understanding and explaining the world. My story about five biologists is a story about five ways of interpreting a very simple phenomenon of frog jumping into a pool. When we come to look at the complexities of our own existence, we have to understand it in all these ways at the same time, and many more as well, because the frog doesn't have society, it doesn't have language, it doesn't have politics, it doesn't have all the things that go to make up the complexities which make humans different from simple frogs. So we need many different sciences in order to understand and interpret the world. We can't collapse them all into the language of physics or the language of biological determinism. Okay, the next point, and in fact several of the next points, seem to me to be saying in several different ways the same sort of thing. And that's essentially this. One of the claims of biological determinism is a sort of fatalism. And it comes out of a claim of what I call ultra-Darwinism. That is, the great metaphor of Charles Darwin was a metaphor of natural selection. That is, that somehow we are passive creatures in our environment. The environment selects us. We are made what we are by our genes. And the environment is like a sort of super streaming or super, as it were, sort of SAT type school test system. It's constantly setting us challenges, and we either pass or fail. And if we pass, then we breed and pass on the good qualities to our offspring. And if we fail, then tough, that's the end of the road. You're down at the bottom stream, you die out, or the Julian Shepherd has nasty words for you, or the teachers who taught you. Now, the contrast with that I want to insist on is what I call active Darwinism. That is, that we choose our environments. We're not passive recipients of our environments. We're constantly choosing and transforming and changing them. Even a simple microorganism changes and chooses the environment. Still more humans. Again, a brief biological fail, but not a fail, a real observation at this point. Take a simple single-celled bacterium, put it in a jar of water, put a drop of glucose, a sugar, at the other end of the jar. The bacterium will swim towards the glucose. That is, it chooses one environment over another. Then, it takes the glucose into itself, that is, it interpenetrates with its environment, it transforms its environment, and it spits out the waste products, a bit of acid, a bit of carbon dioxide, and so on. So it changes its environment. Then, because it makes its environment a bit acid, and it's eaten up all the glucose, it pisses off in another direction again. So, basically, here in this very simple organism, this very simple organism has actually chosen an environment, interpenetrated with its environment, transformed its environment. It is making its own history. It is not a passive recipient of natural selection. that it's in the very nature of living processes that, in fact, we make our own history in this sort of way. We transform our environment. We are not, if you like, therefore, the passive recipients who can only do what our genes tell us. In fact, the biological determinists have a slightly funny argument about this. They are very uneasy about the direction in which their arguments go. They say, well, of course, we may have genes which make us, this book does it, we may have genes which make us criminal or violent, but we can resist our genes. We can actually use our intelligence as humans in order to resist the pull of our genes and therefore do different things from what our genes are telling us. I find that very bizarre. In some way, and Richard Dawkins does it the whole time, in some way, it's as if they're saying, you know, that they're not materialists at all. There's somehow this spirit, this free will out there, this God-given right that humans have, that no other organisms have, to resist the way that our genes are telling us to behave. Now, I'm a thoroughgoing materialist. I want to insist that if we have genes which have a tendency to make us criminal and violent, we also have genes which have a tendency to make us cooperative and to reverse those violent tendencies. Everything that we do about our behaviour is in our genes in that sense. Everything we do about our behaviour is in our environment in that sense. The fact that we can make choices is also embedded in our genes. So instead of talking about nature versus nurture, that old spurious dichotomy, we have to look instead at very different things. We have to look at what I would call specificity, that is the way that we develop as organisms, relatively unchanged by our environment. Take your eyes, for example. Your eyes, you see, because your eyes are wired up to the visual regions of the brain, at the back of your brain. Okay. Every child with vision which is born can see like that. The child's brain is growing, the child's eyes are growing during its whole developmental period. And yet during that period, although the brain and the eyes are growing, the wiring, the connections between the eyes and the brains are kept pretty constant. They're relatively unmodified by environment. If they didn't, you wouldn't be able to see, and no child would be able to see. So that specificity, the way in which, if you like, our genes enable us to be specific and to be unmodified by environment is fundamental. So too is plasticity, the fact that we are modifiable. Our genes give us the brains which enable us to be modified by our environment. So our genes, if you like, give us both the choice of being criminal or violent, or being non-criminal, non-violent, if you want to use that language. I don't like that language. But if you insist on the biologically determinist language, let's actually do it thoroughly and say that it's, we have in our genes a capacity to be cooperative and to make different societies, to be socialist and to be capitalist, to be racist and to be non-racist. All those are as much in our genes as any other aspect of the behaviour which is singled out by the biological determinists. And this leads me to the last point I think I want to make now, and it's again a point about history. The history of us as organisms is a very interesting one. Again, let me come back to the young baby. Young baby, one of the first things it can do when it's born is, of course, to suck at its mother's breast. The sucking reflex is a very important and fundamental reflex as far as the baby is concerned. Within a very few months, as you all know, babies cease to suck and learn to chew. Now, chewing is not just, if you like, a grown-up version of sucking. It involves different muscles, different regions of the brain, different nerves, and so on. So what does every organism have to do? It has a fundamental problem in life, which no other inanimate object has. We have both to be and to become at the same time. That being and becoming, that is the nature, if you like, the dialectical nature of our own existence as individuals. So as individuals, our development is this constant dialectic of development, of being and of becoming, of transcending our present existence in terms of the futures to which we are going. And the very final point in relationship to this, is what is true of individuals is also true of us as organisms and as species as well. It's in the nature of us as organisms, and it's in the nature of evolutionary processes, that we cannot predict the future. Why can't we predict the future? Well, because the future is constantly changing. It's just as I gave you the example of the small bacterium and the drop of glucose. that drop of glucose in that environment is not necessarily just the environment for that bacteria, but for many other organisms as well. Everything we do changes the way in which all other creatures in the world actually live. We know that very well with arguments about global warming, with arguments about extinction and so on and so forth at the moment. But it's a fundamental principle of the way that living organisms operate, that everything interacts, everything connects in that sort of way. And because it connects in that sort of way, it's everything we do changes the conditions for the evolution of every other organism. Our future and the future of life on Earth is radically unpredictable. There are no iron laws of history, I'm sorry to say. There are general principles that we can understand, but has been demonstrated rather painfully again and again for those of us from Marx's day onwards who wanted to predict what would happen to the future of even relatively small segments of human society. There aren't any iron laws. We make our own history, and as Marx quite rightly said, we make our own history, but in circumstances not of our own choosing. So does every other living organism. And this is ultimately why biological determinism is a poor way, it's a mistaken way of understanding the way that living systems operate. And it is a way, above all, which has a political and an ideological function so far as helping or preventing us from being able to struggle against the conditions of our own life. If biological determinism convinces us that there is no future, there is no change, there is no way of changing, that we are simply the passive creatures of our genes, as Dawkins put it, lumbering robots whose job is simply to preserve the gene from one generation to another, we might as well give up. But that's fortunately not the lessons which biology should be teaching us, and it's not the lessons that we should be accepting in this particular context or any other. So the fundamental issue that I think we have to confront, and here I will stop, is, as I said, that it is in the nature of living processes that the future is indeterminate. We have power in our own hands to change it, to change our own history, to change the history of our society, to change the history of our species. And it's the task, I think, of therefore making clear that the arguments of the biological determinists don't stand in the way of making the changes that we all know are necessary.